Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
Hey there, everyone. So we're doing things very differently today. I am hosting. I am here sans Jordan, and I am here with my dear friend, Neil Laird, whom I met in TV land, making all kinds of antiquity television programs. And we started working together on a show that some of you may remember, a little outfit called Digging for the Truth. And we only worked on that one show. And that was how many years ago, Neil?
714 years ago, I think.
714 years ago, we worked on this show together.
That was about probably 12, over 15.
12? Gods in heaven. And so long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away when cable TV was a thing. And then we went our separate ways, but we always stayed in touch. And I then produced my show out of Egypt. And Neil, of course, became a very, very important producer at Discovery Channel and did lots of television in Egypt and elsewhere about the ancient world. And we are here to talk about behind the scenes, how things get done, how things get bought, how much money is involved, because we're loaded now because of this television work, right, Neil?
I'm the richest man, you know.
So 714 years ago, we became extraordinarily rich from this very lucrative
television. We blew it all along the way.
So, Neil, that introduction was very basic and didn't include maybe a lot of your credentials. What do you want to add?
Pretty much Egypt, like everything else, for a lot of the people who are listening, brought me into this world. I was always fascinated by Egypt. And I, instead of going this scholarly route, I went the TV route because I am not very good at language and math and sciences. So I figured, well, what else can I do? I can tell stories about people who do stuff like that. So the last 25 years, I've been doing largely that. A lot of stuff in the ancient world. I've probably done over 1,000 hours of television, 11 years as an executive producer for Discovery, and 4 years before then in National Geographic, but also as a freelancer out in the field. Starting, my very first film was Egypt, actually. It was my thesis film, and I was a grad student at Columbia College Chicago. And I did a show about the Great Sphinx, the restoration of the Great Sphinx of Egypt. And you weren't even allowed to take cameras outside Chicago at the time. I remember they had a policy where, like, if you brought your tripod back and it had sand in it, they knew you were shooting in Lake Michigan. So when I handed my tripod in and it rattled, you go to Lake Michigan? Actually, no, I have not. I actually went to the Sahara, but yeah, I was on Lake Michigan.
So that was you started documentary antiquity TV work with film then?
Well, with no video, this is 96, 97. It was my thesis shot on school cameras, all in the cheap. And the only reason I could afford to go to Egypt, grandfather gave me $14,000 as a gift to do it. Because, I mean, that was big money.
Oh, my God.
Because that was enough to make the film for my thesis. But then also, I was able to sell it to the Learning Channel. So I went right from school to actually making this stuff for the networks. And I've been pretty much doing it ever since.
That's pretty extraordinary. I didn't know that. So that's super cool to hear that story. And you've seen how cameras used to be freaking huge, and now they're these tiny little things you could do everything on your phone.
Beat you down. We'd have to have the cameraman or camerawoman stop every half hour because their shoulder was starting to crack. Now, of course, you can do it on a helmet cam, and it looks, the quality's just the same.
Yeah, and you know what it was like to always have just one camera because that camera was so expensive, so heavy, and then everyone had to repeat everything. We had to do that in Digging for the Truth. I hated that. I hated where you were like, okay, now pretend you're asking the questions, and then you have to give your reactions now to the answers. It was awful. I hated it.
Basically, you get the master shot where we, as you know, Kara would be interviewing somebody, an expert standing in front of Saqqara or something. And then we'd have to turn the camera on you and you would nod and ask the questions and act surprised like you're hearing something for the first time. It's a great deal of acting going on.
Which I don't like. I like being me. I'm very authentically me, and I am not an actress. And so I was like, no, don't make me do this. And that was, so when I did Out of Egypt, my first request, I was like, I have one request, two cameras, always two cameras. I don't want to do this shit twice. I'm not going to act and pretend. I can't. But anyway, let's go back. So you've been working as an executive producer as Discovery. You've been working as third party where they hire you on contract for a short period of time. You've done everything, soup to nuts, right? So you know how the sausage is made. And, you know, tell us like, well, maybe we should start with where we met and how we met, and then we'll lead into some of our stories. But we met on Digging for the Truth when Josh Bernstein had just left, right? Why did Josh Bernstein leave?
He got a sack full of money from Discovery Channel for a project of his own there. Digging for the Truth was a big, big hit for 3 or 4 years. And then, of course, then Josh left. And then because he was big shoes to fill, rather than filling with one, they filled with 4 people. And you were one of them.
Yeah, which was really weird. So there were 2 hosts and 2 technical specialists. And I was a technical specialist.
You weren't called a host? I think I wasn't even aware of that.
I don't think so. I wasn't a host. The hosts were Zay Harding and what's the other guy's name? Fighter pilot.
Yeah, I forget. He looked like a...
He was a fighter pilot. He was a former fighter pilot. And then I'm the Egyptologist. And then some other dude who was like
some weapons expert or whatever.
Yes.
I mean, blow up things in Denmark for me. That was his specialty.
Right. And this was in 2000. Oh, Hunter Ellis. Thanks, Hunter Amber. Ellis. You're the best. Yeah, it was Hunter Ellis.
I remember stuff from 416 years ago.
Or was no. 714, I think. Thank you. It was. No worries. I'm here to help. I'm here. But so then I remember, so I'm, you know, I'd gotten my PhD in 2002. This is like 2006, something like that, 2007 maybe. And all of a sudden I'm thrown into this strange television world as one of the hosts, and they brought us all out to, what's the rock out in, what was it?
I think you did Gibraltar. Were you on that one?
No, before that, when they were doing the photo ops for the marketing, they brought us all out to the rock out in Central California, where they shot all the Star Trek episodes. I can't remember the name of it. Maybe, Amber, you could try to Google Star Trek Central California alien site and see if that comes up. I would be really curious about that Google search. And they put us all on these rocks, and they had Hunter Ellis rappel, and then the other weapons guy to like shoot bow and arrows and shit. Bows and arrows. And I just looked cool in my hot shorts, and I was so skinny. So that was great. And that was so bizarre with trailers. And I was like, what have I gotten myself into? Vasquez Rocks. Thank you, Amber. You're so good. Yes, Vasquez Rocks. So that was my introduction to it. But I had to try out for this show. And I remember when I tried out, they're like, they made me start a fire. They made me like do all this survival shit. And I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
In all the years, I never asked you why you even auditioned. What compelled you to go out?
So in 2005, I did that show, The Lost Queen, with Discovery. And I did that with Brando Quinici. And Zahi Hawass was a part of that show, and that blew up. I mean, I got paid like $3,000 or something like that. And I'm sure Discovery made a shit ton more money off of that one. And when that blew up, many things happened for me. One, I got a television agent who started putting me up for things. And 2, I got a lit agent who saw me on there and was like, you should write a book. And, you know, so it's weird the things that can happen when you're in the right time, right place, and people see you.
You don't realize how many people like the weird thing about making television. And again, I've been, as I said, over 1,000 hours. I don't know the audiences. You make them and they go out there and they're broadcast. And you look at your overnights. Discovery would get something called the overnight ratings, where in certain markets they would see kind of how it did. But beyond that, you have no idea what people were watching, or the TV it happens to be on. The remote control is lost in the sofa. You don't know if you're paying any attention while they're doing it. You have no idea how the shows go over, and particularly social media times where people weren't coming in and chiming in and that. So basically it went out in a vacuum, and it was a very weird thing to know exactly what power TV has, as you're pointing to. More people, I still have people come to me and say, oh, I watch Digging for the, I do Shark Week. I think people were just, they bow at me when I tell them I worked on Shark Week, as if I've done something, you know, magical. Millions and millions of people watch television in ways they don't talk about. And it's not until they come a beer or something that you realize the lasting power it has.
I mean, Digging for the Truth must have pulled in 2 to 3 million viewers on particular evenings, because when I went out of Egypt premiered, we got 1 million views with the, however they measure these things, right? With the Nielsen ratings or whatever. And And that was, it was stunning that a million people could see you. And then on the repeats and everything, millions of people are watching you. But so I have this TV agent, the lead agent came later, but I have this TV agent at this point. I'm working as the head of the Villa Scholars Program at the Getty Research Institute, which is a pretty plum administrative slash academic job. And I had some vacation time and they're like, hey, do you want this job where you can also go to Spain or go to Africa or go to wherever and do these archaeological things? You wouldn't be the lead host. You wouldn't carry it. You would be a part of it. I'm like, I guess. Okay, I'll try that out. And money was good for this one. I got more than my $3,000 or $4,000 for The Lost Queen. And then I found myself on Vasquez Rocks with people putting makeup on me to look chic and disheveled simultaneously. And then all of a sudden.
Glamorously rugged.
Yeah. What did you call glamorously rugged? Yes.
Rugged,
yes.
Yeah.
And I was the only chick out of the four guys. I was the only, and I'm the token woman on the cast. And there were big shoes to fill, as you put it. And so then I find myself out in Gibraltar with you. And you were, I think, the first producer. I did three shows for Digging for the Truth, I think. Maybe four. One on the first Civil War submarine. One on the pirates that we'll get to when we were in Gibraltar and then we went to England. It was interesting. And then I did the Midas Mound in Turkey.
Oh, that's right. You did that one.
And that one was shelved because Zay Harding, they found out that he had been a porn star in a past life. And they canned all of his episodes and that was it. He was used goods or something and you couldn't have a porn star.
I mean, before we
guy.
Get to Gibraltar, I remember I just shot the Gibraltar show with you. We were over four or five countries, a 2-hour special was premiering. And then I wrapped it. And then I went to a wedding in Bologna. One of the colleagues in Digging for the Truth, Patrick Green, I don't know if you remember him, he was getting married in Italy. So I went over there. And as I'm at the wedding, I'm coming out and I get a call from my boss at Digging for the Truth, my ex. And he goes, Neil, you're in Europe, right? I am. Well, while you're there, do you mind swinging back down to Gibraltar? I spent about a month there, if you recall. I'd rather not go back. Why? Well, because we found out that Zay Harding is also Zach Harding, international porn star. And we need to replace all his images and all his faces with somebody else. So do you mind swinging down there and doing it? I said, no. But I remember coming back to the States months later, and it was so weird watching my premiere on my show months, because we shoot these shows long before they air, because of all the post that takes place. When I finally saw 6-7 months, it was my show and my script, but it was not Zay saying any of the lines that I shot. It was a totally different person standing in a tower in Gibraltar, saying the same exact lines that I shot with Zay Harding 6 months earlier. It was so surreal.
And did it come? I don't even remember seeing this episode now, Neil. We're going to have to dig this shit out. But like,
The arms got cut down. Well, there's the other issue we talked about.
Okay, well, so let's go to Gibraltar because that was a shit show. So we get to Gibraltar. And what were we looking for? We were looking for pirate booty because we were brought there because there was some treasure hunter, literally. Naval treasure hunter who was a rich dude who bought a boat and decided to use his boat to go find awesome shit in the ocean. And I remember I get hired to the show and I'm like, this is archaeologically unethical. I can't be a part of this. I can't do this. And this is a problem. I remember conferring with my father, who was a lawyer, and I'm like, what do I do? Do I back out? I've signed a contract. This is a huge problem. And I get there. Two things happen. One, everyone got some stomach bug. Remember that?
I've gotten a stomach bug so many bloody times. I just forget them at this point.
And we all got horribly sick and it delayed production. Everyone was so sick, it delayed production by maybe even a whole day, 2 days. That may not seem like a lot to people, but when you're paying cameramen by the day, that shit adds up. Yeah. So I was like, okay, this is awkward. And then we ended up like talking with the archaeologists on board. I remember his name was Neil,
I remember
too.
Sitting with you, you and I shot that scene. And we found out the archaeologist, it's a loose term. He was not quite an archaeologist.
No.
He's a guy like you would have met in a pub in Scotland that reads archaeology magazine.
Yeah. And so there was all kinds of archaeological shady shit going on, which I found highly problematic and was really not thrilled with. And then, I don't know, miraculously and maybe beautifully, the whole thing fell apart because Neil, tell us what happened next.
That is one of the craziest and most exhausting shoots ever, because I was in Gibraltar. Usually when you're a producer, and at that point I was show producer, so I was in charge of that episode. You go for a week early for recognizance to set things up. So I did all that. I had the shoot all set up on this ship. And the goal was, it was a bunch of, they found a bunch of coins that were minted in the New World by Spain. And they found them, I guess, off the coast of Spain. Was it off the coast of Spain?
Well, because Gibraltar is an English colony in Spain and is still English, but that's a different political province.
We were in Gibraltar, which is British, but they had taken these coins up already and surreptitiously sent them back to Florida without telling the Spanish government. Now, international waters means that really it's whoever finds them, it's squatters' rights or whatever the term is. So theoretically, they were okay to do that, but they were so duplicitous in terms of how they did it. Then they announced to the big press, one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movie was coming out, and they couldn't keep it under wraps. So they announced it in much fanfare. I was in Gibraltar at the time, and the knock-on effect was that the Spanish government shut us down. And when you're in Gibraltar Harbor, you're a safe zone, you're in Britain. But to get international waters, you have to go through Spanish waters. We could not do that.
And so much of the shoot, every part of the shoot was on the boat, out in the ocean, off the coast of Spain, and the Spanish, the Navy blockaded us and wouldn't let
Mardius Leville, they caught us in the middle of the night trying to sneak out of the harbor and bring them with our lights off.
This is madness. And I'm on this boat going, what the fuck am I doing?
The whole shoot is a 2-hour special, which is why it became a 1-hour special, because there was no dive and there was no ROV. And we had you and the other hosts sitting around doing nothing. So after 3 weeks, you can only, and Gibraltar's a pretty boring place. Forgive me, anyone who's living in Gibraltar, some lovely people, but you see the rock, you see the monkeys, and you're done. That's an afternoon. Then you got another month. It's a long bloody month. So then we'll be... We had a scramble. As a producer, my job was to come up with a plan B. And it was Barbary Pirates. And the only Barbary Pirate ship we could find was this ship that had already been found and documented, more or less, in a shambling state off the coast of the English Channel. So we decided to go dig that in, or to dive on that instead. And then you came with me, if I recall.
Yeah, we flew right from Gibraltar into Heathrow and rented a car. And it was you, me, and the Turkish dude who was so nice. I can't remember his name anymore.
Oh, wow.
And we had so much fun. It was just frivolity and driving around the English countryside and trying to, I got to see. So for me, that was really fun because I saw you and you have all of this experience. You've done Digging for the Truth for years, had done already by that point. You did all of these other TV shows. You just told us how you made your way into this whole documentary antiquity business by making a film on your own. And I could see you in the moment going, okay, we got to come up with a new story. We're doing Barbary Pirates, so we can't do it off the coast of Spain. So there's this boat, you guys. So now start researching. Let's see what we can do. And I saw you coming up with the story on the fly, coming up with locations on the fly, coming up with new scripts on the fly. And that was a really formative moment for me in how antiquity TV can be made. So yeah.
Even if it's pre-scripted and almost all television, I mean, the big reveal, rip the Band-Aid off for anyone watching any kind of television, it's almost all pre-scripted. And what that simply means is, and there's a reason for that, mostly it's financial. You can only afford to be in the field for like 6 or 7 days, so you can't go and wing it. And the first film I worked on as an associate producer when I was still in college, Chicago, was a film called Hoop Dreams, which was a big film that got nominated for an Oscar.
I love Hoop Dreams. You worked on Hoop Dreams? Oh my God, that was so good.
I learned more there than I did at Columbia College Chicago. Watching these great filmmakers put together this film. And I mentioned it because when I came on board as an assistant editor in like 93, 94, whenever it was, they had 350 hours of footage. And they were trying to whittle it down to 2 hours. Now, that's what the gift and a curse. You have so much footage. You follow these two kids through high school. And, that's done kind of cheap, but you're going around Chicago, you're going to the kids' home, it's 2 or 3 people. They did that all on their own, labor of love, no one was getting paid. And of course, it paid off because the film was so wonderful. And I learned so much about editing and how you craft. The story arc comes alive in post, not in the field. But in television, it's different because you only have 4 or 5 days sometimes, less today, to go and shoot this. So everything has to be pre-scripted, which is why your interview questions are written down, why we have to know where the ship is in advance, why everything has to be recognizant and checked out before you go there. We just can't afford to wing it.
Yeah.
In this case, I did have to wing it, and we had to find, while we were ticking the clock in Gibraltar, a Barbary pirate ship. And we found one, and it was a miserable wreck, if I recall. We put it in water. It was like, I don't know when we're shooting, but it was really shitty weather. The whole thing was just so sad.
It was cursed. It was really cursed. Yeah.
It was. And do you remember on the way there, we had a car broken into outside of Windsor Palace?
Yeah, my suitcase got broken. It got taken. I remember.
But if what I recall, it's like, at the time, forgive me, I wasn't thinking about your suitcase because we had all.
I know. I took one for the team. Footage
we had shot from Gibraltar in the back seat.
Yeah.
And it was taken.
I remember you almost had a heart attack. And I was like, I took one to the team, you guys. I want everyone to know this.
Yeah.
But essentially, it was
a camera, if I go.
Yeah, it was a History Channel outfit and two rental cars with the cameras in the back and just us, like, you know, figuring shit out as we went. And I'm like, we could say this. And I'm like on Google going, we could say that. And then I had fun because I actually got to be more a part of the creation of the archaeological side of things than not, and got to do more of the interviews of, you know, the archaeologists on site. And it was, well, that was cool.
Where we became friends too, because you weren't just a host showing up asking questions. We were working on it together, and it was clear that you had ideas and you were passionate about it, and pro or con, you were this wonderful working force. And we also laughed. I remember sitting there in some ugly seaside town in England watching it rain and saying, well, here we are. You might as well make the bloody best of it.
Yeah, I found it hilariously fun and really interesting. And to see how a project can just really go belly up and be cursed by one thing after the other. But to watch, you're like, you just got to keep going. The show must go on. And it was shot and it was released. Yeah, it's amazing.
And it was, you know, did it win awards? No. Was it barely eight, episode 12? Yes. But we got it. I remember I had a boss who always said, it'll work out. It'll work out. We'll get there. And I'm thinking, it always works out. The show always airs. Somehow you figure out a way for it and the show airs. And
my show at the Midas Mound never aired. My show.
I love that part of the world. I would have watched that. I would have gobbled that one up.
Well, because I shot it with Zay Harding, and they may have.
Oh, they just didn't repeat it.
They may have put Zay Harding number two up in some, you know, crow's nest up in a boat and had him yell down lines, but they did not do that for the Midas Mound. But it's funny, I got to go into the Midas Mound, which is this wonderful site called Bordia in Turkey, Ankara, near Ankara. And it was near Konya. No, I'm so sorry, Amber, look it up. Oh my God. But it's this extraordinary funerary site that no one fucking gets to go into. And it is lined with cedar from the Lebanon. And it smells like cedar from the Lebanon.
It was cedar from the time period. It still exists.
Yes, it's perfect logs, like all around this tomb. And to be able to walk into this space, to smell this space, to be there, to talk with the archaeologists who were, Brian Rose was one of the archaeologists that I interviewed. It was phenomenal. I got to look at the furniture, the wooden furniture, inlaid furniture from the Midas Mound with the wood specialist, whose name I forget, I apologize, of that material. And it was amazing. I'm like, I can get behind this. That never aired. Okay,
those
fine.
Those are the special moments where you recognize what a privilege it is to do that. I remember my first shoot, you know, the Saving the Sphinx that I did. And the only reason I got it was because I have a good friend. He's still a very close friend in Cairo, whose father was on the antiquities board, and he was Sahi Hawass's mentor. So when his dad says, "These, I have some boys coming with cameras, show them around." And Sahi opened doors for us. I was a film student, and I had no money to give. And I got it because the permits in Egypt are extremely expensive, of course, and even more so today. So when I got there, I was doing the film about the restoration of the Great Sphinx, which they had done very, very badly before. They put cladding stones on it. They got an Italian outfit to. It was basically shedding it. It was all falling off. So they had gone back. It was a great film. I can still remember the stonemason, Saeed al-Nashashi. I don't know if he's still alive anymore. A wonderful old wizened guy from, he lived in the City of the Dead in Cairo. And he was the foreman. He even took me home to dinner.
Oh.
I got amoebic dysentery. First time I got amoebic dysentery was that. But I didn't. It was Ramadan.
We don't have their stomachs and
it
us.
Was Ramadan. And Saeed, I think the shoot had just wrapped. And Saeed very proudly wanted to take me home and show me to the wife and kids or whatever. Say, look at these people that are following. Because he became the star. Sahi was Ainur were the experts, but Saeed was doing so much wonderful work. So I went to his place, and because it was Ramadan and the sun hadn't set, they couldn't eat, but they were cooking up a storm. So his wife saw this heathen out there, this heathen from New York City who would eat anything at any time. So she brought this huge tray of film, this wonderful old trays.
Yeah.
And of goblets and cups full of very questionable liquids and meats and eyeballs. Don't look, I don't know what was going to be. And I could not say no.
I'll tell you what got you sick.
Well, if I did, because... I knew if I did, you know, it would be more insulting than dipping in and trying it.
No, no, this has happened to me. I once got horribly sick from a pigeon that was roasted and presented only to me as the mudira of the group. And I was sick for 3 days and we called it the curse of the pigeon. But I'll tell you what, actually, that was a salmonella probable case. But what most likely got you sick was the water. And it's just normal Egyptian water that you're not used to. So the food is all fine. Everything's clean.
Everything
all of
was
that
cooked.
Is,
I say nothing against them. It's a peccably clean place. It's simply just my stomach was not used to it. And they were living in the city of the dead, which, if listeners don't know, is now it's such a tragedy. They're all gone. I was walking through there a few years ago.
Oh, no, they've destroyed it. Yeah, it's really, it's awful. It's awful.
You need motorways over. But, you know, there was no plumbing there. So I don't know where the water was coming from. So I just tucked in and I was sick for 4 or 5 days, sick as a bloody dog.
4 or 5 days. I bet you got hepatitis A
or something
like that.
And I stayed at my friend's place. His mother is a journalist and his father was a geologist on the Antiquities Board. They took care of me. And remember, all Mrs. Asawi gave me was every day was just potato, baked potato and lemon.
Yeah,
and
that's clever.
Okay, and it'd be okay. And this, you know, if Cipro was around, I would have been up and going in a day, but it wasn't. But she's giving, she was wonderful. She'd hold my hand. It's all going to be fine. Then she's calling her son, Hisham, who lived in LA, and says, I think your friend's going to die. What do I do if he dies?
Oh my God. Because if you're brought up on this stuff, you're fine. But I can't tell you how many countries I've gotten sick in. Or, you know, you just have Gibraltar being one of them. Wow, I was sick there.
One of the things you talk about how many places you have amoebic dysentery. It's like with pride.
It is. It is.
But what I wanted to was, and I got sidetracked to your Turkish story, was on that shoot, one of the most amazing moments one of the most privileged moments I had. And it shows you how wonderful television can be because you can go places others can't. When I was there in 96, 97, Mark Lehner was digging the workers' tombs at the foot of the pyramid. They'd just been found. And he also was our host or our expert for the Sphinx. But they were just finding these beehive tubes and digging up why we were there. And they're very modest tombs. I don't even know if they're even open to the public today. They're right there in the foot of the Giza Plateau. I remember it used to be a stable and then suddenly it became this wonderful graveyard. But I was there when they opened one. And it was Zahi, Mark Lehner, and a couple of the Egyptian experts. And two things I remember that I'll never forget is it was just a mud brick beehive kind of like tomb. And they cracked it open. It was very modest inside. All it was a skeleton. I think he was mummified. And there was some clay jars laying around. This is what, you know, 4th, 5th dynasty, I guess, pyramid age. And as we looked at it, the first thing that happened when we cracked it open, hot air came out.
Wow.
Hot air that clearly had been in there for 4,500 years, entrapped there, escaped. And I can almost feel like I'm probably, over the years I've embellished it, now I say my brows burn. I don't think it was quite that hot, but I felt the temperature difference where all this hot air came blowing up. And I remember poking my head in and there were just very modest, unpainted clay jars, still intact, in situ exactly as they left them. And we went out and we talked a few minutes and I came back in to look. And all those pots had broken in half. They had all crumbled already. As soon as the air hit them, they crumbled.
Oh, my God.
It sat there preserved for 4.5 millennia. And we come along and in 10 minutes.
It's gone. Oh, my God. Yeah. And may I then add this important point that TV discovery is a problem. And doing archaeology on command for a director to find something, and I want your thoughts on this, it can harm antiquities. It can create a simplistic story in which no nuanced research is done thereafter because it's been solved and put onto the TV airwaves. It can limit publication, but it can also harm artifacts. And I really want, because I know you've been there, because you've been there in the moment when things are discovered. You've been there in the moment when things are revealed. And viewers or listeners might be like, but how is that? Well, if you're an archaeologist who knows that you have an opportunity for TV, you might find something and be like, oh my God, this is something semi-intact or intact. I'm going to keep it. I'm going to get in touch with my friends over in TV land. I'm going to invite them over and then I'm going to do this all live on TV. And to see it done live on TV, it has to be done efficiently in a quick manner, according to the clock. You're not there to make sure that things are staying intact or that you slow things down for those reasons. But, you know, I've talked about this openly in talks in public on this podcast about how made for TV archaeological discovery, how problematic that is. But I would love for you to tell us, maybe don't mention names or places, but what kinds of things you've seen out there and how this works.
Usually tombs are usually open before we get there. It's very rare. I've done a couple where they do it where they wait until we show up. But chances are, because we don't want to open an empty tomb, a lot of times it's already been open and we fake the opening, which is the other thing we kind of do. We lie, but make it sound like often like it is the first time we're in there. But both because the experts in Egypt and elsewhere, I've shot in Greece and Rome and all over the place. It's not just Egypt, but certainly I've done my most work in Egypt. They have to make sure there's something in there. The network wants to make sure there's something in there for giving all this money. I think the problem today is less that there's destruction, like I was talking about those pots where we're destroying it by opening it. It's that the system works now, particularly in Egypt, Greece as well, where the digs are funded by the networks. BBC, Discovery, National Geographic, we are the funders. They do not dig. They do not open the tomb. They do not hire the 50 laborers and lock a site down until they have $1 million, whatever it is sometimes. And we buy the season. We buy what? All the experts.
Okay, so wait. Can I stop you right there and say, how much does, and we need to talk about money too, but I'll tell you from an archaeologist perspective, to keep a site going, you need a minimum of $20,000 a year, even back in the day, right? 20 to 50, depending on how big it is. How much are you, so if they're funding the Discovery History, .geo, whoever is funding the dig, how much ends up going to the excavators and how much is kept? Can you give us a percentage?
It all depends on who the lead is. Sahi Awas, for example, he pays his laborers fair. I work with him many times. When he gets that money, we did a wonderful show about a lost city in Luxor with him for a long time, 2 years ago. And, you know, we have to look at the ledger and see where it goes. And Zahi gave his money to the people who are working. Not everyone always does. And I can't say that. It really comes down to who is collecting the money. But those are millions and millions of dollars sometimes. And the bigger problem beyond that is we as a network, we need to find something. So we can't hope that there's going to be another King Tut. There won't be another King Tut in there. It may have been water damage that happened in the New Kingdom, and there's nothing in there if we open a tomb or whatever. So it's a big risk for us. But it's Saqqara. You've probably seen a lot of news about tombs in Saqqara being discovered. And again, it's because there's so many tombs to find that those are the ones the networks fund to bring up. And then, of course, we fund the excavation of Saqqara and Giza for all these usually late period tombs, some old kingdom as well. But the trouble was, we don't have to do with them when we get them opened. We do it for television. So theoretically, they could be destroyed because there's no place to put them. We have so many late period tombs. I went down a tomb shaft a couple of years ago in Saqqara.
The one with Ramadan Hussein? Were you a part of that one?
Yeah. I was visiting it. I was working with another wonderful filmmaker named Caterina Tironi, who did the Lost Cities. And she did a wonderful Saqqara film on Netflix.
And may Ramadan Hussein rest in peace, of course, because he's left us way too early.
Way too early. Good guy. So I went down and saw the other dig they were doing there. And they, you know, there were 50, 60 of these tombs and wooden coffins down there. And they're amazing to look at. I have wonderful photos of me holding masks that hadn't been touched for, you know, 2,000 years. But it was for the spectacle that we deserved, that we wanted, for the show. And then what do you do with it? I hope scholarly work goes up, but there's no place to put them at. Maybe the new Gem Museum will have more space in the back to put them. I haven't been there yet, so I don't know exactly how much conservation work, but I just don't think we need to be exposing all these tombs for no reason other than just to have a wonderful two-hour special. There has to be a big reason why we bring them up to the air, the atmosphere, and we let the decay start.
But Neil, this isn't anything. This is something that archaeologists do in addition to TV discovery. Because archaeologists are digging all over the place. They find awesome things. They expose them. They photograph them. They put them in their volumes. At least they should. And then what usually happens, because, as you say, there's no room in the museums, though the gem is being built and there is much more space now for all of these objects. But things then, the special things, like the mask you were holding, for example, they go into a specially constructed wooden box. You've seen them. I know you know what those boxes in Egypt at least
look like. Open a lot in the back rooms of museums, right?
And then that box holds all of these special things and it stays on site generally. And then when you go back as the archaeologist with the concession of that site, you have an inspector there who has the keys to that box, can open that box, you can study and work on things, but they generally stay in the box. And what GEM has allowed, the Grand Egyptian Museum has allowed, is the opening of many of those wooden boxes from tombs and sites and temples all over the country to be put into a museum context. But so, you know, that's an archaeological problem. That's not just TV. That's any time you uncover something and you don't have a plan for where to put the materials.
Everybody, every archaeologist, anyone who's dig wants to find something. I do think it's exacerbated by the fact that we are now so symbiotically attached to one another that we need each other. We need the programming. We need the story. They need the money because we're funding it. So we have to come up with more stuff. We can't just... You can't do an entire hour on conserving a ship that was found in 1968. You have to find a new ship.
Well, let me ask you this. Besides the pots that you saw crumble before your eyes, which, you know, you don't know what a sealed tomb space that is now suddenly exposed to the open air is going to do to the material culture that's inside of that space. But what have you seen with anecdotes in which antiquity TV has been directly at fault for the destruction of or harm of antiquities? Can you name anything there?
Where the antiquities, you mean the...
Where the TV production itself has harmed things or has harmed the process of the archaeological work or has rushed it or something. And I'm not trying to, to fish. This has happened.
I don't know if it's a knock-on effect so quickly where our being there has destroyed something. I certainly think a lot of times it forces people to act quicker before they have all the answers. And again, to open tombs before they're ready, because we're on a schedule. We have to get in the first, fourth quarter or whatever. So it has to be. So there's this sense of kind of this harried approach. And therefore, sometimes the full archaeological work isn't done because, you know, if we're paying for a dig, for example. So now it worked out with the dig that we did with Zahi and Katerina in Luxor, which is an amazing site, the city they found during that wonderful triangle going to the Valley of the Queens. There was pressure there because we bought the entire dig season, we being Discovery Channel.
Yes.
And it wasn't until very late in the game until we found something wonderful of note. So there's this great intensity to kind of get that stuff done, you know, before we lost our license and then somebody else can pick it. And they did. It's still being dug. And a different outfit is now reaping the benefits of it. So that's more of an internal thing. I do feel like there's really good archaeologists in Egypt. And there's a lot of people who are not driven by what television demands are. And they don't just ride roughshod over there. I work with them. I saw this, the Lost City, and I saw this even at Saqqara. These people already care about their heritage. So I think a lot of them would not be rushed. And that's a wonderful thing. And I think sometimes... as an EP, those are the hard lessons to learn, where it's like, we have a show for fourth quarter, but there are far bigger things at stake here than our two-hour tentpole event for Christmas.
Yeah.
And acknowledge that and admire that. So I do think there are systems in place.
And then let me stop you there, because that's you. And you care about the antiquity and the antiquity TV. Not everybody does other parts of the world. And so if you're there going, look, conservation takes time. Coming up with your conclusions takes time. Give us something nuanced, but not, you don't have to have it all figured out. Or we'll film the conservation as it's happening and that's all right. We'll wait and come back. not everyone does that. And so you may get, and I know you weren't a part of some of the live TV programs that came out, but doing things on live television, which they don't do anymore because live television, except for the Super Bowl, isn't really a thing. But, you know, I had real problems with the archaeological ethics of that. But so you're one producer. There are many others.
It's true. And I can't speak while other people make their shows. I can speak for what I saw and the people that I met in Egypt and elsewhere. Certainly, I mean, there's a lot of things. They're not just fudge, a lot of things that are, you know, I've also done nature programs for National Geographic and mystery shows for elsewhere. There's a lot of fudging going on sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of times if you don't have it, you create it. If you don't get it, then we just have to create it in post. So that is certainly something that's driven by television, because we found out very early on shows like Oak Island or whatever, every week they don't find something, and that's okay. In a show called Searching for Bigfoot or something, it ran forever on one of our networks. Of course, you never find Bigfoot, probably because he doesn't exist, but it didn't matter. Happy to go along for the ride. So you don't have to always have the big payoff. Egypt's different. I think that people, it's the Howard Carter effect. It's the King Tut thing where we want to see the glittering gold. We want to see those wonderful things every time. And we probably never will. There might be one or two hiding.
But you do. You just said, Saqqara, there's always another tomb to be found. There's always something
but
new.
But honestly, if you watch them, you know, maybe because I've seen so many of these, I'm just thinking, oh, it's another late period boxed wooden tomb. They should look a bit samey after the while. And we even have conversations with the network saying, oh, we can't do another. I don't want to do Late Kingdom again, Late Period. I need to find a King Tut mask. And we're
good
looking.
Good luck. Everybody's good luck. Yeah.
So you have, it's also the novelty. And the novelty is the stuff that's tricky.
So how do they bring you in, Neil? So they'll find something or think they found something. And then somebody in Greece or in Egypt or Peru will be like, hey, Discovery, History, whatever. Do they go to all three? Do they broker this shit and create an auction?
Yeah.
I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, when someone has an idea, now that I'm back on the production side of things, I no longer work at Discovery and I'm back in production. I'm talking to a lot of producers in the field and archaeologists and things like that who have ideas or trying to pitch. And, you know, the money is tricky because the business has changed so much. There's a lot less money to go around. So a lot of it's now co-production. You got to get money from France. You got to get money from ZDF. You got to get money from China. And then
how much money? How much money to make?
Budgets were much higher when we started. But now they want more for less. So the budgets are shrunk. The shooting days are shrunk. So you kind of, which is why you pre-script stuff, because you can't wing it as much. But I'd say that is a solid one for anything when you're in Egypt. Also, the production, the permits in Egypt are outrageous. I can't remember what they are right now. You know, tens of thousands of dollars a day or something, just to put your tripod down on the Giza Plateau. So a lot of money goes to that as well. So because of that, the networks don't want to take that risk.
Mm-hmm.
And finding nothing, finding, you know, Al Capone safe. It just happens to be, an old kingdom safe. Yeah, exactly. They don't want to. they'll say, we'll get the money from somewhere else. I'll give you 300. I'll give you 200. If you can raise it here. So a lot of producers are now having to go cap in hand around the world to get the money. And it takes a long, 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 long time, which is both good and bad, because Egyptology and archaeology takes a long time, but you may lose it. If somebody else gets in there first and coughs up the dough, then that's who they go with. So it's a very, very difficult thing to get a show off the ground and to guarantee that you'll find anything. There's a lot of pitfalls along the way.
So say you got your $500,000, you're ready to do your 1 hour special or whatever. And what do you do next?
Well, I guess I was at the network side for those 11 years. So I was the one that would approve the project and then the production company would go out and make it. But let's wind back when I was that person working with you that actually came up with it. Once, let's say we get the okay from whoever, from we'll say Discovery or Nat Geo, whatever, then we have to come up with a game plan of what we're shooting day by day. We've got to find experts. We have to lock down.
And let me just say, that's when I get the email saying, hey, I found you on the web and I see you're an expert in X and Y. Could you, you know, come to Egypt, or will you be in Egypt on date such and such? And I'm like, no, I will not. And thank you. And then I say, my rate is this. They say, okay, never mind. But anything. Okay, so go on.
I throw in a couple people your way and say, but I warn you, Hera's expensive. She's worth it, but she's expensive.
Yeah.
You have popped up on a few of my shows. They must have deep pockets.
I mean, I don't do much anymore, Neil, because it's, you know, TV is, it's a fickle mistress. And I choose very, very carefully. And it's just not the same business that it was. You know, I really enjoyed producing my own series. I only made 6 episodes because of the enormous amount of work that it takes. And so I understand, you know, what it is you're talking about as a producer. But anyway, so go back. So you find your experts and then, yeah.
You find it and of course, then you have to lock it all down. A lot of this logistic works, and there's a thankless job called associate producer, and he or she is the one that has to lock everything and do all the thankless work. And then they're lucky they'll go on the shoot, but often they won't. But then you're off and you're running. And a lot of times you have to, again, the Gibraltar story is a good example. Things don't happen when you get there. And I remember I did a show, a shipwreck show for History Channel called another one of the strangest shows I ever did. It was all set up. It was a weekly show. It was a low budget, deep sea detectives. And each week we had a pre-script that these two guys had gotten dive on dives. We already knew they were there. And so they'd find something and we pretend like they found it or whatever. But it was all mystery and how the ship got down there. It ran for 4 or 5 years.
That's a long time.
And I did a lot of episodes for it. But one of them totally fell apart because the story was so controversial. It was about a ship full of migrants coming from Sri Lanka. They were sneaking. This is the Christmas of 96 or something. But this is many years after that I did the show. But a bunch of immigrants from Sri Lanka were sneaking across Christmas night during bad waves from Malta, and they were trying to get into Sicily. And the captain forced them from their ship onto a launch boat, which is a very small boat that can take 15 people. He crammed about 40 or 50 young men from Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And of course, it sank like a stone.
Oh.
And it wasn't until a couple months later when bodies were being found in fishing nets in Sicily that the authorities were alerted. And then a reporter from La Repubblica up in Rome broke the story. He went down, he talked to the fishermen, he found out the location, and he went out there and took an ROV down and he found some of the bodies. And it was a big tragedy. And of course, the government didn't want to admit it because, you know, they didn't want them. The Italian government was trying to cover it up. Yeah. So great shoot. And I remember, and it's funny how I find it too. Like, I remember thinking, we need shows, ideas. And I'm Googling shipwrecks Mediterranean. And then sadly,
you found this immigrant story. Yeah.
But anyway, I went there and long way to answer your question, had it all scripted out, talked to the guy from La Repubblica. He was coming down. He was going to get the same ROV operator, the same ship to go out and go to the same coordinates that he went down. We were talking to the same people.
And this is important. Forensic archaeology, this kind of political archaeology is valid and must be done.
Ancient.
Yeah.
This was, you know, I probably 5 or 6 years after the fact, and this is something that was very little known. But then I got there, and none of it came to pass. We went out in the ship, we had the coordinates, and we never found the wreck or the bodies. We went up and down, mowing the lawn, as they call it, you know, with the ROV, and the shipwreck either wasn't there, or the mafia who was behind it all got to the ship captain and said,
yeah.
When we got there, all of the people who spoke the first time in Sicily to this guy would not speak to us. They didn't even want to stay in a hotel. They were very cold to us. The mafia got to them. So we got there. We literally had nothing. We shot for 4 days. Somehow I patched together a show and we talked about how we found nothing. It was the biggest, most boring, you know, turd that I ever probably made.
No, you can turn it into Anthony Bourdain Goes to Palestine, West Bank. I mean, there are things that can be done. So there are political discussions. Like, I remember that episode where he goes to I think it was the West Bank. It was occupied Palestinian territory. And he talks about food. He talks about politics. He talks about being caged and enclosed. He talks about settler colonialism. And it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful. It's not archaeology. It's food. But food is political as anything else. And archaeology is goddamn political, as we learned when we were being blockaded by the Spanish Navy from the Gibraltar port. But, you know, those stories need to be told as well. And so kudos to you for trying to do it. It's too bad.
It's a wonderful story. And I already wish we had done more with it. It was a story that still remained unknown. And of course, there's so many stories like that. But of course, in terms of the production, it all fell apart. And it's just a mess, and it's the stress that goes on. People, I'm sure you heard this too. Oh, you're going to be in a shoot. Can I carry your bag? Because I'd love to come. If you knew the work we have to do when we get there.
Yeah.
Particularly if one person doesn't show up or if it rains or.
Yeah.
Climate, then, you know, it's like. It's horror. It's a horror show.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm amazed that everything in Out of Egypt went as well as it did. And of course, my experience was very different because I'm coming in as talent. And this is my ex-husband, Neil Crawford, and I, we pitched the idea as the traveling Egyptologists. And instead it became Out of Egypt. And it was, you ask a big question about humanity in Egypt, and you're like, what is this about? Why do they build pyramids? You know, what's that? Or why is religion and violence always connected? Or why do people get buried in different ways? And then you start in Egypt and you go to Vietnam, Italy, the Americas, Peru, China. You know, you go to all of these different places and you come back to Egypt and you try to answer your questions. It was kind of inspired by James Burke's Connections, if you remember that old, wonderful documentary. And they gave us a shit ton of money and we're like, here, shoot this. It was 2007, 2008. And, you know, I went. It was like a second PhD. I got to interview archaeologists and art historians and specialist historians all over the world and learned all kinds of things about topics I never would have thought that I was learning about. And then went back and edited all of that and tried. Because we did it in the way we did, we often had to script it after the fact, which was interesting and fun. And then you would use your voiceover to create that story. And I enjoyed that. And then I realized how much work went into it. But more importantly, the financial collapse had just happened in 2008. And that kind of TV was dead and gone. And it's never come back. I mean, I know that there are some BBC shows that get to continue in that manner. But
one series ago, but too many beyond that. Most of their flat that go way back.
Yeah. So, you know, so I did six episodes, Neil. I did six episodes. And I'm like, dude. I don't think that we would be able to do this with the kind of money that we had for that show. I don't think that the system exists for not only shooting it and funding it, but airing it and getting people to fucking watch it. So, like, what, may I ask you, do you think the future of antiquity television is in this extraordinarily technologically adept world? Where there's no money or no interest and everyone's attentions are scattered by 1,000 different things. I mean, how do we go forward with this in the future?
Not just with antiquity TV, but with television in general, so many people unemployed because of all the mergers and the streaming. Yeah. Television to me is, I see it as tantamount. My father was a steel plant manager in Pittsburgh.
Oh, it's so perfect. Wow. What goes around comes around.
And I remember him turning off the lights and firing everybody in the 1990s. And as a plant manager, you know, he closed Standard Steel Latrobe and he tried to get the best deal we could for people before the place was shuttered. That's kind of how I feel what's happening with television. Television is not going to go away, just like steel didn't go away. It's being reinvented, but it basically... gone,
and we're talking about scripted television too, not just non-fiction scripted television, like fucking all of it.
That's a whole other podcast talking about why television, there's so much content on, so why is it so hard to make it and why is it so hard?
And we just went through the golden age, so what the hell? But right now, no one's buying
money,
shit.
Too much money with spending, but scripted and unscripted, and all of the streamers and networks, particularly because of mergers, they're tightening the belt. And Egypt and antiquity TV never raised that big. Egypt, it truly is evergreen. Rome, Egypt, Greece, they always are evergreen. Those three.
That's
very
doing. Yeah.
It's fascinating. You go through, there's actually a list I haven't seen in years, which time periods rate, which ones don't. Civil War.
This is why I wanted to do Out of Egypt. So if I go to, Amber points out and Nazis, and she is so right.
Oh, I've got so many Nazis shows, Amber. Oh.
That's so true.
You're in anything. UFOs, bunkers, kickoff in Britain, hit rates.
And that's why I wanted to do Out of Egypt or the traveling Egyptologist or whatever. So you could go to Vietnam, you could go to Peru, and you use Egypt as the candy shell to attract everyone and say, Egypt, Egypt's here, and everyone watches. And then you throw in some American indigenous archaeology. You throw in some Peruvian archaeology. You throw in some anthropological theory they don't know. And tell a good story, but use that thing that attracts everyone.
Again, because Egypt is so well known, I think that I really like the show Out of Egypt you did. Because again, it was a new way telling stories. And we were talking about the Rolex trade in one episode and stuff like that. And you know, me, at least from my approach, I know all about that stuff. But starting back in Egypt, winding it all the way back and seeing how things started and seeing then how things developed long before Europe was on the scene is a fascinating way of retelling stories we thought we knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
Egypt is a strange, Egypt is a place that is loved by many people. Obviously, anyone listening to this, but it's not as understood. Rome and Greece rate better. Books on Rome. I'm a novelist as well, and my first book is about Egypt. And I had one agent say, well, if this is only ancient Rome, I might be able to sell this.
I mean, Neil, who watches TV? Old white men watch TV. And what do the old white men think about every moment, every minute? How many times in a given minute? Rome. They're thinking about Rome. So you got to put Rome on there. And there is a white supremacy angle to that, naturally. And then, yeah, so of course that's going to rate better for TV.
Exactly. And I think because we also see ourselves, it's so ironic, we see ourselves in a culture that's, you know, 1500 years dead, but we can look to the Greco-Roman world and we think we see ourselves because of the banks we build and you drive through downtown DC and you squint and it could be Athens or whatever. It's not like that. Even it's this own weird fucking beast of a creed. You look at it, it doesn't connect with our world, which is why so many of us love it. It's beyond logic in our world. And now you look at it and that breaks down. You realize everything's logical. They're very logical people. But I think it's that otherness about Egypt that is both so appealing and makes it so sort of intangible and why not as many men, it's not always as strong. It's seen as feminine. Egypt is literally meaning that Egypt skews female.
Oh, the goddess comes to us and I love it. Just like, so one of the TikToks that Jordan sent me when the men are thinking about Rome every minute or whatever, the women are thinking about astrology. And, you know, Egypt was one of those inventors of astrology and the fact that it skews feminine makes perfect sense. And that's all my colleagues, right? Egyptology is very much in the Western world, a female run discipline, which is really interesting in the United States, certainly, maybe not as much in Europe, but yeah, but Neil, you're dodging my question. Where does antiquity television go in the future?
Look, if I had some tea leaves and I could flip them over and read them, I would tell you much. But I do not know. I do think it's going to be less of it. I do fear because it's expensive and because everything right now is spectacle. And I have my name on a couple projects that are out there with big production companies trying to sell stuff. But they say, well, you know, can we get Morgan Freeman or can we get X for it? No, we can't. Well, they don't think we're interested. Either you have a celebrity or you have to have a tomb, King Tut's mask. There has to be a huge hook. So I really think, I wouldn't say the days are numbered, but I think I see less and less of those shows. Or you can see the cheap and cheerful versions of that stuff, which is all archive, talking heads, and animation. I did a show called Unearthed for several years, which is a very solid archaeology show. And the way we got around a lot of the expense of digging and stuff is we did animation. So we would recreate the Parthenon, we would recreate Stonehenge, and we would zoom through it. And it's a wonderful way to dynamically bring that back. And the reason I think that show worked so well, it was telling it in a fresh new way. And to answer your question, I think that's what it's going to have to be. It's going to be cheaper budgets and a new way to tell oft-told stories. Because you do not want to tell. I was listening to one of your podcasts, we were talking about the Cleopatra Netflix thing. And you all wonder why we're doing bloody Cleopatra again. Because no one cares about, even Hatshepsut won't rate.
Wow.
They care about a half dozen things. And we have to go back to that same well over and over again. The trick is finding a new way to get in and get out, a new hook. Like you did without it. You talked about Egypt, but then you're allowed to go talk about medieval France or whatever. And therefore, you could tell a different story, but you have to wrap it up in that stuff. And I think, unless there's going to be big, big budget archaeology shows where it really is a big find and we have, and people would expect a big payoff and a celebrity attached, it's going to be cheap and cheerful shows that are going to be, you know, not look that great. And my husband, he's not in television. He was briefly in television after he hated it. He kind of said, why are you still doing this stuff? You know, well, paid for this house in Brooklyn, but beyond that, he doesn't, what he watches is he watches YouTube every night.
Yeah,
he will flick on, and I'm sure tonight when I go to bed, he will flick on and he will watch some 20-minute thing about the Habsburgs or something, and it's just someone droning on a bunch of flat art and maps of Germany.
Yeah, yeah,
that's okay. He doesn't need blue chip drone shots, you know, flying over Vesuvius and over Luxor or whatever. He just wants the information. So I think what's happening is, in a way, it's good because it kind of pulls it back to its source, its information.
It's away from the spectacle and back towards the restricted knowledge, information, and what the experts have to know. In a way, it's kind of awesome.
Wonderful. Those of us who make it, and like I got into this business for multiple reasons, but one is I love to be transported, not just make them. Even before I started making these films, there was nothing more fun. I remember watching a documentary on ancient Egypt and National Geographic, the late 70s. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that. That old study, yeah, just before she died.
Yeah.
And I saw it when I was 10 or 11. To me, it was just so magical. It was on PBS, and I watched it every time it aired for the next year or whatever. It was so just to see that aerial shot over Karnak. I got the chills right now. It's just that transporting feel that you could only get from a film. You don't get that from a YouTube thing wanging on about the Habsburgs for 20 minutes.
No, you don't. And my husband, he watches the same. He watches Japanese travel logs where they go on a ferry to a place in Hokkaido. And then they got their lunch. And this is the lunch. And it's so delicious. And they're using their iPhones. And it's fine. You know, I put up with it because he also gives me a back massage simultaneously. So I'm like, you can watch whatever the fuck you want to watch. You get it. But I get my back massage. It's all good. But like, it's so interesting to see what people are, it's not just willing to watch, what they want to watch, because they're going towards the content and they're putting in keywords for searches and what it is they end up getting. But, you know, I'm thinking about this because I have the mind in many ways of a producer, and I have the mind in many ways of an educator who likes to be entertaining, and sees nothing incongruous about entertainment and education. And I think the two must and should be put together.
Entertainment should not be a curse word.
Yeah. But for most of my colleagues, it is. But then what could I do when my son's a little older? He's almost 14. Let's get the boy out of the house. And then maybe, you know, I could start traveling around and looking at things and bringing my iPhone and talking and saying, oh my God, I'm looking at this thing right now. I don't know. I'm thinking, how could I potentially get into this game? Do I want to get into this game? But then I see influencers and social media that makes me tired. And then I say no.
Yeah. So it's nothing you want to be. We're all too old to be influencers at this point. You know.
Yeah.
But I bet the stuff is out there. I think there's two ways. A lot of people, particularly on YouTube, they're okay just following somebody around. This is my journey to the Siwa Oasis. Let me just show you what it looks like. I will watch those things too, because again, I just want to go to the Sea Oasis one night. Then there's other things that are information heavy, and finding that blending can be a little tough because it's two different audiences, I think. But I do find, I had a very interesting experience. We're talking about like who watches our show. I really don't know, but I had this surprisingly enlightening experience a couple of years ago when I was shooting in Egypt, and I was down in Luxor, and I was invited by Zahi to go on his boat. He does cruises, and he talks to a bunch of people who do these very expensive cruises. They go from Cairo down to Luxor. And then if you pay extra, you get to sit with Dr. Hawass and down when you're in Luxor. And so we had this big table, and they're mostly Americans, middle-aged Americans that came from Texas or elsewhere, and they were starstruck. They could clap for Zahi. But then shortly after, I sat there with the producer and myself. And then something happened and took the producer and Zahi away. And he goes, okay, talk to everybody. And he left. And there I am left with all Zahi's fans alone. And it's like, I don't know who these people are. They just paid thousands of dollars, you know, to sit at this guy's table. And now he's gone. So I started making small talk. And I told them that I work at Science Channel. I do What on Earth and Mysteries of the Abandoned. They pricked up their ears and they were so excited. Suddenly they were starstruck again. Everyone has seen these shows and they want to talk about these shows. And they didn't want to talk so much about behind the scenes. They want to talk about the shows and the story we saw about the Serpent Mounds in Ohio and whatever. These were the people, these were our audience. And these people still love this information. So they almost forgot that Zahi had left for half the lunch because somebody else had come along and gave them what they want. They want stories. They want to go somewhere exotic and they want people to give them little information along the way, not too much, to make them feel like, you know, and they can feel like they don't understand the parameters of things, but they want to go on an educating journey and they want to see those things. That's that sweet spot in the middle. And I don't think those people go away. So trying to find them again, or do they?
Well, Neil, so that's what I'm asking. Is this generational? Because the people who watch cable TV are an older generation of people, boomers, maybe
all
Gen
these
X.
People are fit.
Yeah. And so what are we going to do? Millennials don't watch cable TV.
My nieces in their 20s or whatever, they've never had cable. And I mentioned any of my shows and they've never heard of them.
No. And they don't care.
That's just the, that's why they have to be big and glossy, or they have to, we say, skew old. All those shows like What on Earth and stuff, they skew 50 and 60. But once those viewers go away, once they cut the cable, Science Channel, I was a EP for Science Channel for all those years at Discovery, and doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
When the merger happened with Warner Brothers last year, they let us all go. So it's all repeats now going forward. So that's an audience that doesn't exist. Smithsonian Channel is gone as well. Now Geo is greatly pulled back on a lot of those. But I guess that stuff, that I do think that stuff is evergreen. People want those kind of stories. So how it comes back, I don't know, but I don't think it's over. I do think we have to find new ways of telling those stories, whether it's on YouTube or whether it's going to be an influencer walking over the boulders and ruins of Luxor, or if it's people are going to demand those big glossy shows back again, the younger people. It remains to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was super fun working with you. It's amazing that we only worked together that one episode, because we've been friends for so long and we've both done TV for so much time after that, and kept tabs, obviously. It's just, we were talking. I'm like, wait, we only did one show together? How can that be? It's really
exactly
strange.
And how many shows? I was thinking four or five. How many episodes? No, I realized, no, it was just one show for like a week. It wasn't even in Egypt.
No. I mean, we made an impression on each other, obviously.
It was in the English channel. It did. Yeah, it was like, you know, it was over sushi in Windsor.
Yeah. How crazy. Absolutely crazy. Well, Neil, we're going to have you back on and we're going to talk more about TV, about your work and other things. But this is our introduction to what it's like to make antiquity TV, where it's going, why it's going away right now, and maybe what it will come back as. But I really just want to thank you for giving us your expertise, your experiences, all of these stories, all of this information. It's so fun and interesting to listen to you, and thanks for being on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Oh, it was great fun. Thank you both for having me. It's just a lot of fun. And reminding me of these stories I'd forgotten about from years ago. It's great to tell them again. So usually I do the question asking, not the answering. So it's kind of a nice flip.
Thank you. And usually Jordan asks me the questions and then I answer shit. And this time I got to interview
you. Yeah, right. It's the truth for both of us.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was really fun. So I really enjoyed that, but it's the first of more talks. So you'll be back, and Amber will be lurking in the background with smiles, which we can see.
She's working her butt off. I can ask her, like, what's the capital of Sri Lanka? You know, she'll tell me in 5 seconds.
It's so true. Oh my God, that's awesome. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you soon.
Next time. Cheers, both.
Bye.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack, Ancient Now, at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for @Karakuni. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.